Most recently in the news was the release of the iPhone, the new iPhone. So what I've been reading is some people are upset because there's a feature where they look at your face, and based on your facial recognition, that's how it unlocks your phone. So some people were not happy with that, because if the cops pull you over and want to get information from your phone, they could just point the phone at your face and unlock it that way. Right, that too. All right, that too. Or, you know, what if you have a beard and then you shave, or if you do something to your face, whether by medical or by accident. So the question of revealing people's private information, right? That's the topic. And the case that I wanted to look at is the case where there was a terror shooting in 2015 in California, and the shooter had an iPhone, which the FBI got a hold of, and the FBI basically came to the courts and said, we want to force Apple to unlock the guy's phone so we can get information. Theoretically, the information that they would find on that phone would help them to arrest other criminals, terrorists, prevent other attacks, etc. So it's a multi-layered and leveled question, but kind of the large, broad question is, does halacha sanction prying or finding out information for some purpose, right? For some, for some actual, to find out, for example, a person is dating and wants to find out about a potential person to go on a date with, and you want to get information on that person. So if you use means that are not, let's say, public information, you can find out about a person, you're using some other means to find out information about a person, or you're going to go into business with someone, or you're going to have some kind of interaction with someone where it's a real connection with that person, you want to find out information about them. That might be, fall under the category of information that's important to be able to engage in that kind of relationship. So are you allowed to go and find out that information without them knowing? Right? They're never going to find out. So even just calling somebody up and asking them about X person or Y person, are you allowed to do that halachically? What about hacking? Hacking into someone's confidential files or email, but not sharing it, right? Never letting the person know that you saw their information. What does that carry? Gets into questions about wiretapping, hopefully Big Brother watching you, right? All that stuff. Checking people's internet history or medical information, things like this. These are all important questions, and halacha has what to say about it. So that's kind of the broad opening point. So I want to start with the Gemara. The Gemara is in source number one. It's on the back of the page. This is just an article from National Post on that story. In the end of the story, by the way, the judge ordered Apple to reveal the information, and while the case was still unfolding, the FBI figured out how to unlock it before Apple did. So now it's even easier because it's facial recognition. So right. Well, that's you mean now? You mean updated terms and conditions? It could be. It could be they changed it because of the case. I'm not certain. But at that time, there were strict confidentiality rules, and that's basically what Apple argued, despite the fact this guy was a terrorist. So halakhically, does it make a difference that he was a threat to people's lives, and his information on his phone could help authorities save people's lives? So the first Gemara is the Gemara Masechet Yoma, and the Gemara discusses the concept anytime in the Torah where Hashem says lemor, right? Vayikra el Moshe vayidaber, and then the pasuk ends with the word lemor. So the idea that Hashem says, now take this information and share it with the people, and share it with Bnei Yisrael, and share it with whoever you're sharing it with, it brings us to the following principle, And we'll have to see in a minute if this is just what we call, you know, ethical behavior, or if there's actually something more strict related to it. So it's here in the second line, English translation is underneath, and the concept is lo yomar adam davar lechaveiro ela im kein korehu korehu, which means a person shouldn't say something to, I'm sorry, the third line. Minayin le'omer davar lechaveiro shu beval yomar at shiomar lo. So if I share information with anyone here, so now I'm teaching you and we're learning together, and I share something personal, or I share something something that is dear to me, private information, let's say, how do I know that you shouldn't share that conversation with other people unless I gave you consent? Where does it come from, the idea that you should get consent from someone before you share a conversation that you had with the other? And the answer is, comes from the fact that every time Hashem spoke to Moshe, and he specifically uses the beginning of Yikra, Vayidaber Hashem Elav, Me'ohol Moed Lemor. Right? This whole idea of Lemor is Hashem saying to Moshe, now everything I just said to you, I'm giving you the consent to go and share it with the people. So this is going to get into the area of how we use our speech and how we use our language. I mean, if you look in source number two, the Chafetz Chaim, in his Sefer on Shmirat HaLashon, he says the following. Here's the halacha, source number two. If one revealed to his friend the presence of three, so now now something is a little bit more public than in a private conversation, right? There's going to be a difference that we can understand between saying something to one person versus saying something to a group, and a group here is going to be defined as three. Three is a crowd. So details of his occupation or trade or the like, which are maybe things that you could find out through public means, but most likely types of things that are more privately shared. Things which, in general, are otherwise forbidden to repeat afterwards to another, lest this result in injury or pain to him, turn the page. Since he himself revealed in the presence of three, it's evident that this is of no concern to him, even if it comes to be known in the end. Once you've said it to three people, the likelihood of that making it to other places, right, is much higher than if you had said it to one person. So by saying it to three people, the Chafetz Chaim is saying is that you've essentially given permission to those people to share that information more broadly. Therefore, one who hears it from him is permitted to reveal to others so long as the teller does not make it clear that he's opposed to his doing so. So if I say to you, I don't want you sharing this, even if it's with a crowd of 100 people, unless I've made that statement, you have permission, consent, my consent to share that with other people. If I said it to you one-on-one, you would have to get my permission. If I said it to you in a group, so that's essentially what he says here in the commentary in the bottom. It's this idea that this isn't necessarily something that's a prohibition. It's what we would call etiquette. It's just the right thing to do. If someone said something to you and shared something with you that's private, that's important, that's sensitive, perhaps, don't just assume that information is now for you to do with whatever you'd like. So it may not be a prohibition, because the Rambam does not include this in the Mishnah Torah. And the Chafetz Chaim points that out here in the commentary, Perush Be'er Mayim Chaim. I'm not going to read it inside. But he doesn't mention this Gemara. Then the Chafetz Chaim says, even if you say that there is a prohibition, it's only when it was shared in private. Right? It's only when it was shared in private. But once you've done it in public, and if you look here in the Rambam, in source number three, He says this explicitly. He says, the statements of people who relate matters, and he's defining what Lashon Hara is, right? Who relate matters of people, relate matters which, when passed from one person to another, will cause harm to a man's person, to his property, or will even merely annoy him or frighten him, are considered as Lashon Hara, right? So he's defining Lashon Hara, and the reason why this might be different than classic Lashon Hara is because this isn't like a prohibition. This is just, it's just not a nice thing to do. If someone shares something with you, it's just not appropriate. It's not social etiquette. It's not a normal social thing to do, to just go around and tell to other people's information. Even if they probably wouldn't mind if you said it, it's just not the right thing to do. So is it a prohibition? Probably not. But is it etiquette? For sure. So again, just to review, because these are things that are important. You have a conversation one-on-one with someone, get their permission before you repeat the information. If it was said more broadly, right, to a few people, once it's being said to a few people, that is what you might call automatic consent, unless the person says otherwise, to share that out. So we have a pasuk in the Torah that says, Lo telech rachil be'amecha. Right? What is a rachil? English translation is a gossip monger. Okay? But what actually is this? So there's two statements that are made by different commentaries, quoted in a lot of places. I just brought them here in source 5 and 6. So the Smag, Sefer Mitzvah Gadol, he writes, Ezu rachil hamagalela chaverot varim shadiber bimenu adam beseter. If you reveal to someone information words that were shared with that person in secret, right? So the whole thing is about sharing private information. That's rachil. You're taking information from one place and you're transplanting it or bringing it to another location. The Rambam takes us further or gives somewhat of an alternative idea. Who is a gossiper? Who is a rachil? One who collects information and goes from person to person saying, this is what so-and-so said, this is what I heard about so-and-so. Even if the statements are true, they bring about the destruction of the world. Okay? So that's always the classic. Lashon hara is still Lashon hara, even if it's true. And rechilut is a category or a subcategory of Lashon hara. So these are isurim, right? Rechilut is already, we're talking a prohibition from the Torah, lo telech rachil ba'amecha. And then you have the ethical side of it. Look, if you look in Shari Tshuva, a person is obligated, in source 7, a person is obligated to conceal a secret revealed to him by his fellow in a secretive manner, even if revealing of it would not involve rechilut, because the revealing the secret causes damage to the owner and results in the foiling of his plan. And second, one who reveals a secret deviates from the path of modesty and violates the wish of the secret's owner. One second. So just to summarize, so these aren't Torah prohibitions. This is just saying, it's not senua. It's not a modest way to live, to just go around sharing people's information with others. And number two, it's a breach of trust. That person trusted you with that information, and you went and shared it with somebody else. Go ahead, questions.
So far, though, this is only talking about a case in which someone told you something, and it's at your discretion whether not to say. It's not about breaking in and finding things.
We're getting there. Okay. We're getting there. Yes. This is all about information that you picked up by hearing.
Willfully.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Correct. 100%. So what actually is transgressed when you violate somebody's privacy? That's what we're going to look at in the coming sources. What Torah prohibitions are you over when you violate somebody else's privacy? And this may not necessarily make a difference whether you got it willfully or whether you got it through some other means, some active means. So the first comment that's made here is from Shelot Shvach HaKikei Lev, from one of the Sephardic, later Sephardic poskim, Chaim Palagi, and he talks about the idea of a hafta l'reicha kamocha. It's an interesting idea that somebody else wouldn't want, you know, somebody else wouldn't want their information revealed. You wouldn't want that for yourself. Mad alecha sani. So he invokes that idea of a hafta l'reicha kamocha, and that would be incorporated under this idea of revealing somebody else's or breaching somebody else's privacy. If you turn to the backside in source number 9, there's another concept in halacha called shoel shalom idat, she'ela shalom idat. She'ela shalom idat means I'm borrowing something without somebody else's knowledge, right? And in the Gemara, there's a debate in the Gemara whether this is actually a form of theft or not a form of theft. That's a debate in and of itself. That's why I call, you know, I take your watch, I'm saying I'm borrowing it without your permission. So some would say that's called stealing. Right? If you borrow something without someone's permission, you're taking it for yourself. You didn't ask them for it. So there's a debate. There's a debate about this. But source number 9 seems to say that, and it would be based on, and here's a larger question, which is not out of the scope of what we're talking about here. Do you own your information? We recently had I work a lot in IT in the school, in Or Chaim and Olpana. And we have a little bit of a network of technology people in the city and different schools. So we had a meeting at the beginning, end of the summer. And one of the discussions was about people that work in a business or in a school, and you have an account, right? So you have an account, let's call it a school account, a teacher account, or a business account, and it's under your institution's name. So when those people leave the institution, what happens to all of their information? Right? Are they the owners of information? Or does the school own their information? Does the business own their information? So if they created 6,000 lesson plans on their Google Drive with their school account, right, with their teacher account, does the school own that information or does the person own that information? Just because you created it doesn't mean that it necessarily belongs to you.
The idea of intellectual property in general is very iffy.
Yeah.
Like,
So this concept of she'ela shelo midat is going to be is going the basis of it is that you have some kind of ownership over your information.
Well, she'ela shelo midat is, I thought normally it's about objects. It's you're away and I borrow your
right. So is information an object? Right. So you're getting into this. I saw a commentary that said that gazalnu that we say in the slichot. Right? What's one of the ashamnus, right? Gazalnu. Gazalnu doesn't just include people's items, but prying, right? Looking at people's emails or things like this might be included under gazalnu, which is interesting. I don't know if they meant emails, but, you know, something of that nature whenever the commentary was written. So those are two ideas. So we have Haftarech Kamocha, we have She'ela Shelo Midat, which may be a form of theft. And then we have, if you look in source 10, Lo Telech Rachil Be'amecha. Right, so the prohibition might be not just sharing the information, but also accessing it. So this is where it comes in. If you look in Halacha Ketanot, source 10, Yirshei Sur Levakesh Lechapes Mistorav Shel Chavero, to try to find out other people's information. So this gets into, and it happens all the time. One friend is sharing something with another friend, and then you're like on the side, and you want to know what's going on. So you trying to get that information and maybe pressuring that person might not be such a wonderful thing to do. Ethical, halachic, these are all interesting questions, but that's really what it comes down to. Yeah?
For the takanah of being Gershon, not opening people's mails, I was out there.
We're going to get to it. It's coming up. It's coming up in a few sources. But thank you for bringing it up. And the Chavetz Chaim writes, and this is interesting, in Source 11, he says, just sitting in a room where that information is being shared, you're a willing or even passive participant, he writes, my son, do not sit with the companies of those who speak ill of their friends, source 11, for when their words rise on high, they are inscribed in a book, and all who stand there are described as a wicked company. Another issue that might come up is the issue of Hezek Re'iyah. Hezek Re'iyah is a whole discussion in the Masechet Baba Batra, which is based on, you guys remember Masechet Baba Batra?
That's our favorite.
Oh, there you go. So did you study not to put a window opposite the other person's window? Did you do that? Did you do that stuff? Okay, so you'll recognize this. So the Mishnah says a person may not open an entrance opposite another entrance or window opposite another window toward a courtyard belonging to partners, right? Now the question is this a prohibition or is this etiquette? Right? It gets back into this question of where's the line between zoning law policy versus Torah prohibition or some kind of rabbinic prohibition. And it's based on, where is it based on? Matovu O'alecha Yaakov, right? Bilam. Bilam Arasha was trying to curse the Jewish people, and he ended up giving them a blessing. And what was one of the blessings he blessed them with? Wow, how amazing are your tents, right? Jacob. And Rashi and commentaries explain that was the fact that the tents of the Jewish people opened up, but were not able to see, look into the tents that were across the way. That's exactly what the Gemara brings here.
Once you, if you were to say that this is only etiquette and not real halacha, then you'd have to say that about all of Baba Batra, no? Because it's basically no psukim whatsoever.
So it's very interesting. It's very interesting. It happens
like
to
a
be
very dangerous,
right. It happens to be that this is basically a machloka between the Rambam and the Ramban.
Okay.
In Masechet Baba Batra. So the Ramban in source 13, he says it's a prohibition, straight up in Isur. And the psukim from the Torah and all of that's a source. And the Rambam, he basically says, I didn't bring it on here, but you'll see it in the halacha in a minute in source 14. The Rambam says, if a window is built with neighbor's consent, right, and it's opposite the other window, the owner doesn't have to seal it. And the Rambam says, even if the guy 25 years later decides, I don't want you looking in, I don't want you having a window opposite mine, he can't repeal his consent that he gave once upon a time.
But you could still say it's halacha, it's the type of halacha that's based on societal norms or whatever, or I guess not societal norms, but, you know, it's should be, right? It's like contract laws also, you can have a shot that says anything you want, but it's the idea of it could still be halacha, even if the specifics of it are up to, you know, the way societies or the way people are, much like you have with Begadisha,
right,
where it's completely societal.
Right. Right. It does bother a lot of people, in particular, this Hezek Re'iyah issue, that it may only be, I don't know, a low-level isser or at worst.
I'm comfortable with it being an isser.
I'm just saying, when you learn it through, it seems like something that should be so important that everybody, you know, should be jumping on this, but didn't get as strong condemnation in commentaries maybe as people would have expected it to. But if you look in 14, so the Rama has a very interesting addition to this concept. He says, even according to the opinion that one can obtain a right to have the window overlooking, this applies only to the window itself, as the yard's owner cannot seal it or protest. So that was the Rambam that I mentioned. Then he says, however, it's forbidden for him to stand by the window, meaning, yes, it's true that you could build that window, but that doesn't give you the right to look, to just stand there and look into the other person's property just because you have access to see it. So he doesn't cause damage through his viewing. That's called Hezek Re'ia, as he thereby commits a violation. There's no presumptive right for this, and the yard's owner can protest it. So the Rama, by the way, here is quoting a tshuva of the Rashba, and the Rashba, the case of the Rashba was where a window was there for 25 years, and all of a sudden the guy was actually starting to look a lot of the time, to start looking into the other person's property. As he says, even though you may be allowed to put that window there, that doesn't make it all of a sudden permitted to stare and to peep and to peek and whatever. And the Shulchan Aruch Rav writes this straight out. The Shulchan Aruch Rav, there's the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, he says in his Shulchan Aruch in 15, people in the public domain are also not prevented to stand and look into someone's property, but there's no concern when they glance briefly as they walk. Okay, that's not an Isur. What are you going to do? You cover your eyes. You got to see where you're walking. That can't be avoided. Person must conduct himself modestly in affairs regarding which another's brief glance would disturb him. Okay, even that, I don't know. I think there's some phobia or something. Medical people in the room, people who are afraid of being looked at, even glanced at. There is some condition I've heard of like this. So that's a very hard thing to live with. I'm not talking about people who are self-conscious. Everybody's a little bit self-conscious, but it's the people giving you a glance, not because they're looking at you, just because that's what's in front of them. So that's difficult. So I put on here very interesting, Yitzhak Zilberstein, who's a modern-day posik in Israel, he has all kinds of interesting applications of different halachot, and he has a whole case here about hospitals where people walk by hospital rooms. This is an amazing application. Says people want to look in. Who's in the hospital bed? Who just gave birth? Who just, you know, all this? It's a big problem. If the door is left open, that's a bad thing in general. But if you're walking by and you happen to be there, looking in would be part of this issue of Hezek Re'iyah. And then he quotes, it's in very small print, he talks about the ambulances, and this seems to be only a thing in Israel, that whenever there's something going on and people get in an ambulance, everyone runs over and wants to see what's going on. And he says it's mafria first of all to the chole, and it could be a chole sheish bo sakana. It could be an issue of embarrassment to the person that everybody's looking in and seeing who's going in. Now, maybe it comes from a good place and they're concerned and they want to know if the person's okay and all of this. He feels it may be infringing on this issue as well. I put in this article, it's fascinating, I can send this out and you can see the full thing. So a whole discussion about the drones. The drone flyovers and whether a person has the ability to prevent whatever it means, coordinates, I don't exactly know how they would figure it out, but for drones to fly over and take pictures and, I don't know, deliver things and who knows what from your property. That's still an ongoing discussion, and it seems to also be part of this Hezek Re'iyah issue. Now, you brought up the question of the Chayim de Rabbeinu Gershom. So the Chayim de Rabbeinu Gershom was a Chayim. A Chayim is basically a decree of, I don't even know how you translate it. Just like a public service announcement decree of the time. If you come up with a good translation, you let me know. It's not classic chayim, right? Charamot is something else, right? Charamot is a different concept. So the chayim is basically against it's people. Similar. It's similar, 100%. Similar. It's related to the word. So his chayim was against people reading the mail of others, and specifically, you're not allowed to read somebody else's mail without their permission. And if you're in possession of it, you have to destroy it. You have to get rid of it. That was basically his chayim. So if you ended up with somebody's mail and you weren't able to get it back to them for whatever reason, you try to get it back to them, a shavat aveda, that applies. But if you aren't able to get it back to them, then you have to dispose of it. So he talks about the question of a postcard, right? the original discussion was where sort of the information was in an envelope of some sort, and you had to open it to be able to get the information. But a postcard, everything's there, right? So the Aruch HaShulchan talks about this, and he says that, I'm sorry, I said the Cherem Derbeinu Geshem wrong, I apologize. Cherem Derbeinu Geshem is, if you will throw it out, you're allowed to read it. If you're going to get rid of it, meaning the person will never find out that you read their mail, you're not allowed to read it in the first place, but if you're going to throw it away, then you are allowed to read it. Okay, so that's a discussion. Yeah, that's exactly how he says it. I know it sounds weird.
Isn't the whole point of throwing out so you don't get it? It's not yours.
Well, no, it must be said as something that there is, or along those lines, instead of knowing what it's about. Like it's, as in presumably it's either, I would say it's probably either embarrassment or like getting them in trouble type of thing. Where like
I'm sorry. Let me start again. I reread it and I read it wrong. You can read the mail. Start again. Okay? It goes like this. You're not allowed to read the mail, period. If the person who owns the mail threw it in the garbage.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Okay? I just confused it. If the person who, oh, was the owner of the mail, threw it in the garbage, then it's for the taking. Okay? Although that's already an interesting concept. And then he talks about postcards, which where you can see because there the person's not trying to hide their text or their letter, whatever it is, by putting it on a postcard. Maybe they don't have as much of a care. It's not private anymore, right? By putting on a postcard, you're not necessarily. So the question becomes: email, is email the type of communication where you are really not expecting that to ever be seen by anyone other than the recipient? Or is email the type of thing where you're leaving it open to the possibility that, like, a good possibility, let's say, of it being forwarded on, or, someone leaving your laptop open and someone seeing it, or, you know, things like that. The question is, like, where does email fall in? So Rav Re'im HaKohen, who's the Rosh Shiva of Yeshivat Otniel, he has a whole article on this. And in source 19, in the summary of what he says, is he feels that email would be included in the Cherem, that email would be included in the Cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom. And he writes, "B'yechas lehoda text uledor electroni, email, barur she'in kol havdel mimichtav mustar, v'in shum heter likro mail, v'hoda shal zulat v'over al zeh over b'cherem." And he assumes that you don't expect your emails to be seen by anyone else, in general, you know. And if it was that kind of email, you would either write confidential and you don't, you know, please don't forward this on, that kind of thing. And even in general, you wouldn't necessarily want people seeing your communications. But it is an interesting question to think about whether email is the same as these other examples.
By saying confidential or something, the subject does not suggest that other types of email are not confidential.
Maybe. But it's, you could argue that. But the way I see it, the way I understand it in my head is, you're saying that as an extra precaution. You really, really, really don't want this person to forward it on. If you didn't write that, then that person hopefully is intelligent enough to see the content of the email and decide whether this is something that they should share or not share. Yeah. You know, or like even I don't even know what putting a code or something on the email or.
I feel like email is like an enclosed letter, and like a text message and other things are like a postcard.
Mm.
Because like the email, it could have like the subject title and whatever, and it could be like, $10 off. But,
right,
like,
right,
I don't know.
Right. I don't want you to miss the. I don't want you to miss the conclusion. We're going to wrap up right now. Okay. Listen to this. So there's obviously going to be areas where we are allowed to snoop, where we are allowed to find out information. There's a halacha about. Shiduchim, that you're allowed to find out certain information, especially for medical issues or for issues that would prevent a person from being able to be married with someone. Physical disabilities and things like that, these are things that are important for a person to know. A person's supposed to be attracted to the person they get married to. And you're allowed to find out these types of details. So that's in a few, brought some pieces from Shulchan Aruch here. But clearly, and without going into all the other sources here, this may fall under some of the discussions about, I put this here in the last sources, 24, 25, and 26. Lo Tirtzach, Ibn Ezra writes, Lo Tirtzach includes, right, when a secret's revealed to you that you can actually save a person through that information, you can save their life. If you don't reveal it, then that might be considered lo tirtzach. You're an accessory to murder. That would be, I don't know, using the legal terminology in that sense. The Emek Davar, the Netziv writes, very interesting connection between. If you look in the pasuk of lo tilech rachil, this is a well known. Someone's nodding their head here.
Well, no.
No, it's a great point because in the pasuk it says lo tilech rachil b'amecha and lo tamar odam reyecha, right in the same breath. Not to stand idly by your brother's blood, and not to gossip. So the Netziv, he writes that the connection between the two is, yeah, in general, you shouldn't share people's secrets and information, but if it could help to prevent murder or death of someone, then that information should be shared. And it wouldn't be, you know, a transgression of that Isur. So it's a beautiful source on that. And the last one I just brought is a tshuva. Rav Moshe Sternbach, tshuva on Hakod, Rav Avad Yosef has tshuva on this as well. Let's say a doctor uncovers some kind of information about a person that could be a threat to society, i.e. they have an eye condition that would make them impaired for driving. So do they have to go with that private confidential information and go to the government or the Ontario Ministry of Transportation and let them know that, you know, X person has such and such eye condition? Today's world, they're going to end up finding a lot of this stuff anyway. But let's say they wouldn't, and let's say it's the type of thing that, you know, let's say it's the type of thing that really could save lives. So both of them, in different tshuva and different arguments, come out with this kind of idea that if it could save lives, and if it's a type of thing where it's information that's relevant to public health and public need, then we would in a sense say that. That type of information is information we should share, we should have access to, and we should share with those to help out. So coming full circle, the whole discussion about getting the information off the guy's phone seems to be something of a pikuach nefesh or life-threatening type of situation. It would probably fall under the category of information that we would need to be able to help save somebody else's life. And with that, we will close. Wish everybody a Shana Tova.